Welcome to Headlines. This week we have a wonderful program. We have Harav Pinchas Goldschmidt, who is the chief rabbi of Moscow and president of the Conference of European Rabbis, who has the most amazing story to share with us. And he will discuss, you know, the history. He's been in Russia 26 years when it just emerged from communism. Perestroika, and many of the Kiruv Shilas that he's encountered as Rav there, and just a fascinating story. And we also have a very controversial Rav later on in the program, Rabbi Yosef Mizrahi, who is a popular Kiruv Rav. He has actually over 100,000 hits on YouTube on his various videos, and he has, you know, I think 380 YouTubes, and he's gotten into a bit of trouble with some of the remarks that he's made, that some of them are a little bit, honestly, a little outlandish, and he's going to talk about them. And he's been vilified by the Jewish bloggers like Yeshiva World, MSV Emunah, etc. And I think it's important to say that a lot of the bloggers, as well as their commentators, think that they're doing, you know, a good service when they call somebody out for making an inappropriate remark. And that could be correct. But on the other hand, we do have a Shulchan Aruch, and Chafetz Chaim has written extensively about Lashon Hara. And having good intentions isn't enough. We still have to adhere to the Shulchan Aruch and to the, you know, the 17 klalos that the Chafetz Chaim discusses, and to discard the whole Chafetz Chaim and what the Rambam says, somebody who's a continual medaber lashon hara is ein lo chelik le'olam haba, puts a lot of these bloggers at risk. They certainly would like to have a chelik le'olam haba and not have a geder of a nichrasa. So good intentions are not enough. So attacking what somebody says as incorrect is one thing. The Gemara, Abaye, and Rava, they disagreed. But because Abaye said, Yish shalai midas, loy have a yish, and Rava said, have a yish, Abaye didn't call Rava arrogant or a fool or etc. Ad hominem attacks are very different from disagreeing with somebody's opinions. And good intentions don't count. We have a Shulchan Aruch. Let me share with you a story of good intentions, you know. There was a fellow, he was very, very spiritual, and he, you know, he was a musician, and one day he was reading in the papers about a homeless man who died in the metro section, and he didn't think anybody, didn't appear anybody would be by the funeral, by the levaya. So he decided he was going to go to the levaya, take his guitar, and sing some fantastic Kalbach or Mazitzur or whatever your favorite niggin may be, and get people, whoever was there, or nobody, maybe the Shechina, to be Nesayer. So he jumped into his little car, and he saw that it's someplace in Jersey, and he got lost, and it was already close to dark, and he sees a few people digging, and he jumps out of his car with his guitar, and he runs there, and he sees that it's already three quarters full. He says, you know, it's never too late, it's never too late. He says, I just got here just in time when they're putting in the last shovels, and he takes out his guitar, and he starts singing that it's never too late, and he starts crying with this homeless person. And then the next thing is, he starts singing, Lamana Chai V'Rayoi, we're all brothers, we're, it's all about love and brotherhood, and we're bound in one world, you know, Kigavna, Dinu Misyachtem Be'echad, we become one. And soon everybody, you know, the diggers are crying, and he's crying, and after an hour of them singing together, he goes back to his car, he feels all good. And when he goes back, the diggers look at each other, and one says, you know, I've been installing septic tanks for 20 years, and this has never occurred. What an interesting occurrence. So good intentions don't always count. There are rules, right? And we're gonna talk to him, and he will actually say why he said that, etc. But again, I am the first person to say when somebody makes a mistake in halacha, etc., or in hashkafa, we call them out. But it has to stop with ad hominem attacks. I would like to say a short word on the parasha. You know, this week, Kaviyachol is upset at Moshe. He says, Chaval al da'avdin v'loy mishtakin. He says, the Aves, they had so much patience with me. He says, "Hiftachti v'lo kiyamti." I made promises to them. I didn't fulfill them. They didn't see it in their lives. But they understood what happened one day. They were patient. And you, Moshe, are not patient. So I'd like to talk about that for a few minutes because, you know, in America today, patience is the kiss of death. If you go on an interview and afterwards they, you know, they'll ask the boss, what did they, oh, he has a lot of patience. I guarantee you, you're not getting the job. Or if it's a shidduch, worse than saying that a boy is a Baal Chesed, that he's kind, is you could say he's patient. Forget it. Alacrity, urgency, action. It's a call to action. That's what's important. Patience is derided, right? But that's, it's not really honored at all. But I think that's a mistake. You know, the greatest painter, sculptor in history is almost unanimously agreed the greatest talent was Michelangelo. And he said, genius is endless patience. They say when he carved the David, which is considered by many to be the greatest sculpture ever did, he stared at it. He would stay for days on end and just stare at the stone before he picked up the chisel. And when they asked him how he created it, he said, it was always in the stone. I just had to set it free. And there's something really thoughtful about this. You know, I was reading an article about a fellow who was the greatest paddleboarder in the world. He sits on this little strip of foam in the ocean, and he paddles. And they asked him, what's behind this art? It's incredible, behind this, you know, this teeming trillion tons of water, endless. He said, you know, you can't defeat the great ocean. He says, but I close my eyes, and I try to become one with the great ocean. And when I am avatal myself, when I become one with the tempo of the ocean, and I learn its waves and its mood, at that time I paddle and I can go where I want. But if I try to fight it, he says, it's impossible. You can't fight the mother ocean. So what is really patience? Patience is the art of listening to the time of creation, listening to the cosmos, listening to the universe. Because the great Chacham once said, there's nothing as powerful as an idea whose time has come. And you know what? There's nothing as weak as a time who hasn't come. So patience is about appreciating that there's a process in life. Everything has its time. You can't make a cake bake faster. And even Marissa Meyer, the CEO of Yahoo, who just had twins, the biggest genius in Silicon Valley, she still had to have Tisha Yarche Leda. She couldn't rush that. And who understands that? Do you know, we say every Shabbos you go to shul, this is a very Jewish thought. And what do we scream? We scream, if you daven, certainly in a Hamish or shul, you see people scream, Mamish, they say it at the top of their lungs, Mizmar Shir Liema Shabbos. What is the song of Shabbos of the end of time? Befruach Rishoyim Kamayesev. The wicked grow like grass. V'yatzitzu kol poyalei aven, and they flourish. Whereas the righteous grow like a date tree. What does that mean? The song of the end of time is the wicked grow like grass, the righteous grow like date trees. So the Maral writes something amazing. He says nothing grows as quickly as grass. There's something called fast grass. It grows in 7 days. When you want to get a certificate of occupancy on a building, you have to put it down, and in 7 days, it goes, and there's a billion of them. But what happens? One sunny day, and they all disappear. On the other hand, a day tree takes 40 years to grow. But ke'erez balvanei niske, it reaches the cedars of Lebanon. It becomes the highest tree that there is in the Middle East, is the day tree. So patience means understanding the process of time, understanding that things take time to mature, listening to creation, understanding to work. And I think that in our lives, many times I want something to happen today and now, immediately. And what is the Jewish way? What does the Torah tell us? What is the Song of Shabbos? Tune into the cosmos. And that's really the midah of Erech HaPayim, slow to anger. The person that you want, who you're angry at, maybe they're just not there yet. They have to get emotionally, psychologically, in thought, intellectually, to where you need them to be. They're just not there yet. That's the beauty of patience. And that's what the Rabbeinu Shalom told Moshe Rabbeinu. He said, the Avos, they understood that time is a process, that development is a process, that halacha is an avoda. Halacha, you could be mefagel by halacha. So the part of getting there, the journey is part of the process. That's what he said. The Avos understood, and he said, Moshe, you haven't come to that yet. When you hear that a boy has patience, or when somebody tells you have patience, you should see that as an accolade. You shouldn't see that as a detriment. It means that you are in touch with the cosmos. Let's go to our first amazing guest who has a fascinating story to tell.
You're listening to Headlines, Contemporary Halachic Issues. You can listen to us Matzah Shabbos on WMCA 570 from 11 to 12, or at WMCA.com or at NachumSiegel.com. Again, Matzah Shabbos from 11 p.m. to 12 a.m. Or on Monday morning, if you missed it, on Monday morning from 11 a.m. to 12 noon at NachumSiegel.com. Or now on Wednesday evening from 9 to 10 on WSNR 620 a.m. That's WSNR 620 a.m. We have the honor of having with us on the phone Harav HaGoyen, Harav Pinchas Goldschmidt, who is the Rav HaRashi of Moscow. He is the chief rabbi of Moscow. He's the Rav of the Choral Synagogue in Moscow. Additionally, he's the president of the Conference of European Rabbis. Welcome, Harav Goldschmidt.
Thank you for having me on the program. I love it.
Harav Goldschmidt, 99% of our audience has never been in Russia. And it's something we read about in storybooks, and it's astonishing to me that you had the courage to go there and to become the Rav HaRashi. Can you tell us a little bit, try to explain to our audience, what is it like of being the chief rabbi of the largest city in the Soviet Union with, it's so foreign to us. Try to explain, before we go to halachic issues, just a little bit of the experience.
Try to imagine that you're arriving in 1989 with my American wife, Muncie born, and I'm not even 25 years old at that time, and arriving in the Soviet Union, and there are over a million Jews in Moscow, and there's less of a million of 12 children who know the alphabet. Wow. And there's one shul, one and a half shuls. No schools, no kindergartens, no Jewish organization, nothing.
Wow.
And you go in a shop to buy something, and there's nothing to buy. And when you need a car, you have to take a taxi. You're waving some cigarettes, Marlboro cigarette pack, and a taxi stops for you, and is ready to give you a ride for 2 hours. So this was what the Soviet Union looked like in 1989. When I was inducted in office, it was Simchas Torah, 1989, which was about 26 years ago. And I think at that time, there were maybe 3,000 or 4,000 people in shul. It was the beginning of perestroika and glasnost when things started to open up and the Jews were slowly allowed to leave, to go on aliyah, to leave the United States. And there was tremendous interest of the international media for everything. So there were many different TV crews filming and coming to the shul during davening and filming CNN and NBC and many of the other Western media came in, and I remembered, which was a very interesting thing, till I came to the shul, they used a microphone on Shabbos and Yontif. In my honor, they stopped using it. It was a new beginning. It was a new life, and it was like, I would say it was like the end of the Soviet period of the main shul of Russia.
So did people there, did they know anything? I mean, did they know who Avraham Avinu was? Like, how far away were the Russian Jews from Yiddishkeit?
25 years ago, you still had people in the 70s, 60s, 70s, which means 1989, people were 70 years old, were born in 1920, right? So it's, there were many Jews who came from the Baltics, from they came from Lithuania, from Latvia, from Riga, from Vilna, and all these Jews had a normal Jewish lives till World War II, till the Holocaust. They went to Chadarim, they went to Jewish schools, and some of them went to yeshivas as well. So they knew a lot, even though afterwards they lived through the Soviet period. And what was very interesting, that the Soviets, they didn't care if, when retired people went to shul or lahavdil, to churches. They didn't want people, students, to go. They didn't want people work to go to have anything to do with religion. But if you're already over the hill, you're retired, they closed an eye and they didn't care if you went to...
They were fine bizkeinenu, but not binureinu, you're saying?
Exactly. So I was the youngest person who came to shul at that time. The regulars who came to shul were all elderly people.
Was there shchita, kashrus, mikvah, yeshivas? Was there anything?
Yes, there was a sheikhet there in Moscow. His name was Motel Sheikhet or Motel Lifshitz. He just was nifta a year ago in Crown Heights. He was a lamed vavnik, a Messias Nefesh Jew. So sat also in the Gulag in Sabir for 5 years for doing bris milas. And when he made the bris milah, he never went to the shliach tzibur, to the chazan, to tell him that he has a bris milah the same day in order not to say tachnun, because it was more important for him to make the bris milah and not to sit in jail, then the shul should not say tachnun. So he was also the shaykhet. And there was also a menacher, his name was Bel Tovichkin, who was I remember him, a very tough person who served in, this was called a Strafbat, which means a punishment battalion during World War II, and he survived it. 99% of people who went to a punishment battalion didn't survive it. And he was a menacher. So when both of them were in good terms, so Moscow had kosher meat. When they got into a fight, which happened from time to time, so Moscow had no kosher meat. So I remember I was still in the Steinsatz Yeshiva, and the Rosh Yeshiva there was the Monastritzer Rebbe, Rabinovich, who was down in Yerushalayim. And they told me that in Riga, in Latvia, which is still part of the Soviet Union, that there's a Shoichet over there. His name was Gurevich, but there was a shmur that his hands were trembling. So they asked me to travel to Riga and check out the Shoichet, if the Shoichet still... If can still be a shayfetz. I went by train, it was 14 hours by train from Moscow to Riga, and I walked in the morning to the shul in Riga, and the shayfetz of the Gurevich shook my hand, and my hand was hurting for 3 days after shaking his hand.
So you had an answer?
I had an answer.
So tell me some of the experiences. Can you share some stories with the Olam? Were you ever threatened? The Mesiras Nefesh for the Yidden? You must have remarkable stories. Before we go to Halacha, share one or two stories.
I would say up to 5-6 years ago, if you would take statistics of Bris Milas, I think more adult people got the Bris Milas than newborns. I think it's the only community in the world where this was the case.
And what inspired people who were in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, who had never been to a yeshiva, they'd never seen a Shabbos, what inspired somebody like that to go for a bris milah at that age? What was makar of them?
That's extremely interesting. That's something which I think when somebody was going to want to analyze this huge phenomena of a community coming back to its roots, we cannot say that everyone became again 100% Shomer Shabbos, whatever, but we're talking in general community coming back to its roots. I think one of the first steps which was done by many people was doing a bris milah. You know, I don't have to be religious, I don't know too much, but a Jew has a bris milah. That's my stamp, that's the chosam, that's what it means to be Jewish. And a lot of people I know, people were very, very far from Frumkeit, very far from Shmir Shabbos and other things, but they decided to do this. This was the first step. It was like an initiation. It's I'm Jewish, and this is who I am, and I'm proud of it. And those times were magnificent times. The many singers who came to Moscow at that time, from Kalabach came, Yigal Salik with the London School of Jewish Song from London, and they filled up concert halls for 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 people. Any mediocre Jewish singer or Jewish band which came to Moscow at that time and was ready to perform in Moscow drew out huge amounts of Jews. There was an unbelievable thirst to see something Jewish, to understand something Jewish, to learn something Jewish. A lot of people were learning Ivrit, and in many ways it was a Yom Hasha'inbon Chayfetz. You know, people were sitting on their suitcases. They didn't get the permission yet to leave, so they had a lot of free time. And there was nothing to do, so people came to learn. When those young Russian balichuvas who became Fum not long ago started to give lectures in the big hall in the shul, whatever. For example, like Dr. Polanski and others. Thousands of people came to listen to them.
Wow. So it was a time of tremendous Osiris.
Tremendous Osiris. And I would say at that time, the great 1 million Jews, mostly 70% were Jewish, the others were members of the families of the Jewish, they left Eretz Yisrael. And I think lesser number went to the States, and many also went to Germany and to other countries. So, and at that time, we also started to create the Jewish school. School is named after Chaim Berlin. And the problem was that we did not have teachers for Limud HaKodesh. It was impossible. We didn't have teachers for Limud HaKodesh. So I remember at that time we put an ad in the Izvestia, which was like the New York Times of Russia, and that we're looking for Jewish for teachers of Jewish descent who want to become teachers in the Jewish school system, which was about to jumpstart that moment. And I think 70 people answered, of which 50 were Jewish. And of those 50, we started to give them classes and prepare them to become teachers. And they became teachers of our Sunday schools, day schools, and many, many of them became, I think the great majority of them became Fum.
So go back now. So you're talking, let's juxtapose the past and the present. When you came, you said there were a million, and there were maybe a minion who knew, kids who knew Aleph Beis. And what does it look like today, Moscow?
Okay, today Moscow is a city, I think, with at least 40 different schools.
Wow.
We have the 5 Jewish day schools, of which 2 are Chadarim. And we have in the city, we have 4 mikvahs. And we have, I think, 6 kosher restaurants, 3 kosher butchers. And we have about 180,000 Jews today in Moscow.
Wow. So this is, you've had incredible success then.
I would say that the story of the reawakening of the Jewish Renaissance in Russia is, from a historical perspective, is one of the most magnificent stories of Jewish survival and resilience. And I'm thanking HaKadosh Baruch Hu that I was able to do my little bit and take part in this.
So let's talk a little bit of Kirov. What are some of the Kirov Shilas? If somebody comes to you and they say, you know, Rabbi Goldschmidt, maybe not now, maybe 20 years ago, they say, you know, I live in one of the suburbs of Moscow. I would like to drive to Shul. Otherwise, the closest Shul for me, I mean, is 50 miles, 100 miles. What do you tell a person?
This was one of the most important questions we were asked at the end of the Soviet times, that the Soviets and the Russian cities are huge. And there is no Jewish neighborhood. And it was usually every city had one shul or 2 shuls. And, of course, driving to shul was, there's no way to find a possibility to find a heter for that. However, in most big cities had a subway system. And with the subway system, at that time it was not electronic, so it was possible to get into the subway and getting out of the subway without having to show go an electronic ticket. So the question was, A, can you allow it? Or B, if you don't allow it, can you close the eyeball? Which means, can you implicitly invite somebody who is going to use the subway on Shabbos and Yom Tov? So there was a tshuva of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, among the Balei Tshuvas in Moscow, it was known that Rabbi Moshe Feinstein said that to be Mekayim and Mitzvos, it's not also to use a subway in Moscow. So the question was, if this heter would be possible to continue to use in Moscow for in the post-Soviet period. We're talking this heter, for example, to go to listen to a shofar on Rosh Hashanah, or to sit in a sukkah on sukkahs, etc., davening on Shabbos. So, for many years, till they changed the system, we said we didn't say it was mutter, we didn't say it was asa. So, we basically continued the original heter, which was given by Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. I'm saying with the Gdoli Sura, by Rabbi Yashid Ratzah, by others, but then they changed the system, and it was impossible to get into the subway system only with an electronic card. So that it became impossible for many other reasons. I wrote a tshuva about it, which was published in the sefer. I wrote the Shailus of Tshuvas, the Kalamba Sefer. It was one of the biggest tshuva of days regarding using the underground in Moscow.
And what was some of the nidonim? Like, when there was no electronic problem, so it doesn't seem this should be a halachic issue at all. So there, it's just more about, you know, it's more of mice uvda dechoil, etc. I mean, Ramosha's heter is more about uvda dechoil than halacha. Am I correct?
Okay, we didn't go in. There's chasam soifa on that, when the train was invented. The question, why are you not allowed to use a train?
I'm assuming in a city there's no tchumen issues.
Right. It's all on the ground. So this was the question how to carry the ticket, if the ticket was bottled to the baggage.
In other words, you're saying even though it wasn't electronic, you did need a ticket, you're saying. So it was a question of Hitzah.
Yeah, you needed a ticket. Right. It was a question of Hitzah involved, moved to the hall and others. So you're not going to see today an Orthodox Rav who is going to be matched to use an underground or a train system inside the city. The question is, was this in order for people to have some connection to Yiddishkeit,
right,
possible to to use?
And what did you write about when after it was electronic and somebody lived 50 miles away, and if they came, they would maybe become a kesher to Yiddishkeit, and otherwise they would become Uruv Bein Amim. What did you paskin on that?
Okay, here it's very interesting. Here, this is a topic which was discussed many, many times during the rabbinical conferences in Russia, and also we had a rabbinical conference, we had the Bush Weiss, who came to Moscow, who discussed this. The question of velif ne'ivel osite michshol, to what extent, and there's also another thing, which is also Ramesh Slovetsky Gratzal, Laudim L'chaim Chaim, made a difference between if the Rav of the community invites people officially to come to a communal event, there's also an element of Chilul Hashem, if there's some Issur involved. Right, and it's a different thing if a private person does that. So for many years, we were makbid that the Rabbanim should not be the ones inviting the people. But we know that there's this. I know you had a new program, Rav Moshe Sternbuch.
Right.
And who, by the way, also gave Haskom on my sefer when it came out. And he, by the way, has a very specific shita of Velif Ne'iva. He says that Velif Ne'iva is to give a Yitzhavah, to be machshul a person in the Yisra Torah. So he claims that if you invite a person, even though the person by coming is Mechal Shabbos, but since it is Ne'itza Tova, you're not over on this Ne'iva. And this is very makel, by the way. And this is also very symptomatic, because he himself was a Rav
in South Africa, of a
Baal Tshuva community in South Africa. Very funny. I just got I'm making a big event this coming Sunday in... This coming Sunday, I'm making a big event in London, the Conference of European Rabbis, the Internet Prize event, and our guest speaker is the ex-president of France, Nicolas Sarkozy. So I got the phone call from the president of the Zionist Federation of England, who said he wants to come, and they told me, you know who is my rabbi? He says, yeah, my rabbi is Rabbi Sternbuch. So I said, you know, I said, you see how interesting the Jewish people are. The head of the Zionist Federation in England, his rav is Rav Moshe Sternbuch, who is the rabbi of the Eidach Redis of Yerushalayim.
And one of the biggest kenraim in the world.
State of Israel yet.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Anyway.
But you know, Rav Goldschmidt, you know, there's a very interesting Anachlas Shiva that the Mechaba brings in Shin Zion, right? The Taz, that if a girl was kidnapped by missionaries, Amanas Leitzia Min Adas, so you're allowed to be Michal Shabbos. And
right.
and the Taz says, and Anachlas Shiva, who's the Talmud of the Taz, says it Barichas, he says that the same din, like there's a Pikuach Nefesh for a physical threat, there's a concept of Chil Shabbos for Pikuach Nefesh for a Ruchniistic threat. And based on that, it would seem that there's a big makim to be matir because these people would be lost forever. I would tell you that I was in Costa Rica, and in the shul, the main shul in Costa Rica, after davening, I was amazed. The parking lot opens, and it's under the building for security reasons, and 1,000 cars drove away. And the Rav told me, he said, you know, all the children and the Einikoch of these people driving are going to be in yeshiva, and most of the grandchildren will already be learning in Eretz Yisrael. So it's interesting how the Nachlas Shiva and the Taz, and it's brought in Shin Zayin, says, he says, Pikuach Nefesh Ruchni has the same chaymer of Pikuach Nefesh Gashmi, and he brings Kama Vakamarayas, he says, Godol HaMachtiya Yoysemeya Hargoy. So it seems that there is a big makam lahalacha to be makel here.
So I wrote a whole piece on the question the Jewish agency organized trains from Moscow to Bucharest in order to bring them from Bucharest by plane in 1989. This was still in the Soviet times. And people came to me with shailas if they're allowed to go on the train on Shabbos. And the shaila was, it was exactly this Rashba, Pikuach Nefesh Ruchni, the Tshuva Rashba.
Right.
Now, it's...
Well, the Rashba is chaylik. It's machlik is Taisis and the Rashba. Rajbis Machmer and Taisis Michael.
The situation described over there was a very specific. Mishibolo Etzias Bito, they kidnapped a girl from a Jewish family and they brought her to a monastery, right?
Right.
So this was the case. And so it is quite an extreme case of you know, a person being kidnapped and brought into. And to take this case and apply it all over, you know, because I think if this person is going to come to my shul on Shabbos, this is going to save this person by this person listening to my sermon, or this person come to daven today, this is going to save this person from becoming totally assimilated. It is not, you cannot say that this case is exactly
no, it's certainly similar. Not exactly, but it's, but the concept
it's
that
not, but can you say with clarity that maybe that the Jew speech is going to turn off this person off much more to Yiddishkeit than if this person never got come to the Yeshua? It's not something which is as clear.
Without a doubt, Rav Goldschmidt, without a doubt. But let me just point out that Safik Pikuach Nefesh, if would Hatzalah come to somebody's house if there's a 1 in 500 chance that they'll save them? Would you say, could you be Michal Shabbos? And the answer is 100% the Paiskim Neman. So if you think that by him coming to Shul and eating Kugel and listening to the Drasha and sitting for once with Yidin where he doesn't see where he is, even if it's a 1 in 100, Hatzalah would be Michal Shabbos for 1 in 100.
Okay, where do you draw the line? Where do you draw the line? So if I'm using your line of reasoning, so let's go even a step further. You know, people like today, you have a new phenomenon in America, open orthodoxy, or you have the conservatives. I believe that a lot of conservative and reform spiritual leaders would come forward and say, listen, if we wouldn't be so liberal, we would turn more Jews from Yiddishkeit.
It's a difficult line.
And I think the question of having parking lots in shul or not, which is, I think, the dividing lines between Orthodox and conservative congregations, especially in the United States, this was a question where, are we balabatim over the Torah to be so chel to say that we're giving up this principle in order to do another principle? I think to take this whole tshuva harashva, which is a chiddush, it can be used, whatever, but to take it, to what extent to enlarge this, where's the line?
So for that you have to be done, I would imagine, on each case in case. Same
right.
Thing like Hatzalah. I mean, you know, there's an argument that Hatzalah members who drive to, they're always driving and drive. What damage does it do to their families? Do their children see it and say, you know, you can drive on Shabbos? So you're correct. It's a tenuous line. So let me ask you, what would you say if you had to say the two halachic issues that you find the biggest you struggle with or you have the most, what would they be?
The biggest problems we face and to face it all over is the problem of assimilation. Is people of mixed families and families of people who started to be Mekayim Mitzvos, and one part of the family is not Jewish. And having you have it even much more. A couple getting engaged, and both are from or getting from. And 2 days before the wedding, you understand that you find out that one side is not Jewish according to Allah and has to go through Gil. And the questions of Yichus has been a tremendous a challenge to us, not only regarding. Who is Jewish, who is not Jewish, which is the most important aspect of Yichus in terms of community, but also secondary questions. Who is a Kohen? Who is not a Kohen? You have famous case, and I was Messiah with Rav Obadiah, with Rav Vozna, a person who grew up and his grandmother told him that you should know that your grandfather used to bless the people in the community. And he went to a Rav in Donetsk, and the Rav told him, it means you're a Kohen, and he started to behave like a Kohen. He was called to the Torah first, and he was doing Michas Kohanim, he didn't go to cemeteries. And then he's getting engaged, and he's about to marry a girl, and 2 days before the wedding, we find out the girl does not have enough documents to document that she is Jewish, so which means she has
she's
to go a Giyaris, to
she's a Sur Lekayim.
It's Sophic Giyaris.
Yes.
So he's a Sofer Kohen and a Sofer Gil.
Yeah.
And here we have to start.
We have
questions of Ches Kehuna. We have Shavi Anafshech Chati Chedi Yisuri. We have so many Sfeikas over here. And these are Shailas. For example, if it is not so simple that, let's say, a Russian couple, the Bali Tshuvas, and a son is born to them, and do they make a pidna ben or don't they make a pidna ben? Can both the father and mother say for 100% that they're not levim or bnei levim or bnei kohanim? And we know that by pidna ben, because it's mamonos, we don't go in olchim acherov. The shul is tzemach hatzedek. And there's a whole shaila with the kuntros hasveikas, the whole machokas.
Yeah, but the kain has the ability to be meichel. You can always tell the kain to be meichel.
Do you make a bracha or you don't make a bracha?
Well, a bracha, so it's a drabanan. The bracha would be a shayla of a drabanan l'chayra, right? So it would be, you would say safik drabanan l'kula then.
Right, but the minik today, even going among all Russian balichus, etc., the second generation, they all make, if they know they're not levim, not kohanim, they make it up with a bracha. So it's also Chakas Yankov. But it's all interesting questions,
right,
deriving from the questions of Yichus. Right.
It's a whole new Shulchan Aruch you have.
Right. And the first question which was asked, there's questions which were not asked for hundreds of years in Am Yisrael. A person comes from the street and says, I'm Jewish.
So
what basis can you trust?
Well, so on that there's a lot of halacha.
So much. There's a Tosis of Psachim in the beginning. But it was halacha which you take the tshuvas of the biggest achon in the last 300 years. It was not a question because it never happened because people didn't want Goyim didn't want to become Jews.
Right. Well, the Shulchan Aruch says that he's Neman.
Right. Okay. So the question about what base or whatever, but is a person Neman if you have today a massive that it is in to be Jewish?
I understand.
It's worthwhile to be Jewish, right?
Right. Rav Goldschmidt, we ran out of time. All I could say is that it's rare, and I've had many people here on the radio, to speak to somebody who's had such an impact on so many people. I mean, when they use the Kayseres, Rabim Heshiv Meyavain, they could use it on you all in bold letters. But somebody who's made such a difference in their life, it's truly astonishing.
Anyway, thank you again. I just want to say that I did my little part in this wonderful times, and I would like to thank you again for inviting me to speak on your show.
So is there American Jews, is there anything they can do? What would you say to our listeners? What can we do for, is there any way we can be involved?
I think right now in Russia, Russia's going through a tremendous crisis with the falling oil prices, with the isolation and with the sanctions and the counter-sanctions. The ruble has lost 60% of its value during the last year. And I didn't come fundraising in the United States for the last, last 15 years. And I think that I might have to come again. And it looks like the Moistas today in Russia, the Torah Moistas, need more help today from the United, Baruch Hashem, in the United States. The economy is back on track. So I would like just to tell all of our friends and supporters and people who were involved in the Soviet Jewry movement and helping Russian Jewry initially 20 years ago, 25 years ago, that now is a Shasa Kosher, because now the most of us need your help again.
So, and where would they send it to? If somebody wanted to send a check, where would they send it to?
Okay, there's many of our most of us have representation in the States. For example, we have the Shema Yisrael network of schools, over 3,000 children in schools all over the former Soviet Union, which is based with the Canadian Foundation, which was started by Albert Reichman in Toronto, headed by Rabbi Shlomo Noach Mendel, and the Odessa Moses of Tikva, the Kiev Moses, and of Karin Stolin of Yisrael, and also Operation Open Curtain, and the Yeshiva Torah Chaim, which is also has been raising money in the United States. All these ministers have and need help, and we would appreciate any help that Balbatim in the United States would give to those ministers.
Well, thank you very much, Rav Goldschmidt. It was truly an honor to have you with us.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
Kol tov. So that was a fantastic interview with, coming from the Soviet Union, from Moscow in Asia, totally different, was it five time zones away? And now we go to New York City to a controversial, extremely popular Sfardi Kirov, Harav Yosef Mizrahi, who has on YouTube tens of thousands of hits. He is one of the most prolific speakers for Kirov in the United States. Welcome, Rav Mizrahi.
Good evening, everyone.
So, Rabbi Mizrahi, you've been recently vilified, for lack of a better word, by some of the blogs for comments that you've made, which seemingly were parsed and taken out of context. And I would like to know, first of all, if you can just give us a little bit of history about it. And then I would like to go to a second question, which is, is there some type of a halachic heter for Lashon Hara because it's on the internet? But that would be the halacha discussion. But maybe you could just give us a little prelude, as many of our listeners may not know what's going on.
Okay, so you ask very good two questions. Maybe I should start with your second question. Maybe I should start with that, about the laws of Lashon Hara, because I just made a very powerful lecture about it. Very powerful lecture about it I just made, and that's discussing all the laws when a person is allowed to talk and when he's not allowed to talk. And I explained that a person, by publishing Lashon Hara, meaning even if it's 100% the truth, right, is violating close to 30 different violations of the Torah, 30 different ones. there's no permission for any Jew to publish online anywhere, even in the websites that are calling themselves Haredi, meaning from. There's no permission whatsoever to publish any information over there, nothing. Because the Torah says that even if you publish the truth about a person, that's also not permitted. When you actually add details to the story and modify it and make it look different than what it really was, then it becomes already motzi shemra, which is a double violation. Not only you're publishing information without permission, now you're adding more details into the story. Now, when you have these websites that call themselves from, when they actually describe the current events in the world, there's a war, there's meeting between leaders, none of the above is a problem. We're not violating any one of the rules. But as soon as they publish something about a Jew, any kind of Jewish person from all over the world that was caught doing something wrong, and assuming that all the details about him that they copy from different news websites, it's all correct, once they're publishing it, the more people watch it, the more violations they commit. So if they have 1,000 views, they actually made 1,000 sins from the Torah. If they have 1,000,000 views, they just made 1,000,000 sins from the Torah. And now they open option to comment. People comment, and a lot of people speak in dirty language and all kinds of bad lies, and they add all kinds of things to the story, and people begin to fight with each other, and it creates false hatred, and sometimes it even breaks families. All of that tragedy, all of that goes to the editor of that newspaper, to the owner of that newspaper, all the people who work and participate and brought the news and publish it. They basically put themselves in a situation that in 1,000,000 years they won't be able to fix it. And so, I'm talking about one article only.
Rabbi Mizrahi, can I ask you a question, Rabbi Mizrahi?
Yes.
If somebody gives a speech,
yes,
and people disagree with the contents of the speech,
right,
would it be Lashon Hara to, on a blog, disagree with the contents?
Well, they can disagree with the content. There's no problem disagreeing with the thing. They can send their disagreement to the speaker directly. They can write him an email. They can tell him what they find wrong about it. They can even ask him to publish an apology or anything like that. It has to be done between them and the speaker. They don't have permission to run to the media and publish their thoughts that the whole world has to start comment, and they know exactly what's going to happen.
Well, Rabbi Mizrahi, is it possible that there's a difference between disagreeing with the speaker and making personal attacks on the speaker? In other words, the speaker said this and I disagree. I don't know if that would be Lashon Hara. I think it would be Lashon Hara if they said, the speaker said this and I disagree,
yes,
and therefore
right,
the
you're
speaker
exactly, you're
is
right,
not...
Exactly right. As long as they come and say, I disagree, that's no problem. They didn't actually do anything malicious and personal against that speaker. They can say, I have a different opinion. I based my opinion on this and this and that. Even the greatest Jews in the history, the biggest rabbis, they had disagreements. And they knew how to respect each other. And they apologized politely one to each other. And they contradict each other. But they definitely didn't do it in such a malicious way that they call names and make up lies and add all kinds of details to the story and change his original words, by me is a very, very common issue. Now, I attract a lot of fire because I'm the type of speaker that do not hold back. I present the Torah exactly as it's written. And many, many parts of the Torah are very offensive to wicked people, right? When I speak against gay marriage, a lot of gays get offended, but it's in the Torah. When I speak about people who break Shabbat and they don't keep the covenant and the consequences and the punishment and what the Torah describes that will be their end, they're very, very upset to hear it because they don't want to take responsibility for their actions and for their sins. When I speak about all kinds of things that right away they look at it as a personal attack that I have against them, but that comes out of ignorance. I don't have any personal attack against anyone. I'm not a judge. I don't judge people. I don't wish anybody bad. All I do is teach Torah, and I teach how we have to behave and what we have to do.
So, Rabbi Mizrahi, is it fair to say that La Halacha, on websites like the Yeshiva World and etc., if they got up and they said, look, a mistake is made, it's not true, etc., they're allowed to do that. But to but to write an article that attacks you personally and is mavazi you, and to allow commentators to write nefarious and damaging and insulting things about you, that's Lashon Hara. It's the Yud Zayin Klolus that the Chafetz Chaim writes about, and that the owners of that site are Misayeya L'Dvar Aveira in a serious way, and the Chafetz Chaim says that somebody who's a Misaper and a Moelech Lashon Hara in a serious way is Ein L'Chelek L'Olam Haba. Is it fair to say that they have a right to protest what you said, but if they attack you personally, the people who are the owners of the website that do something like this are Misayeya L'Dvar Aveira and the Zechshash of Ein L'Chelek L'Olam Haba? And is it additionally possible that to advertise on a site like that would be us or else Misayeya L'Dvar Aveira?
Absolutely. Not only not to advertise, to enter there even once, just to enter and read what they write, it's already Isur Deoraita. To publish advertisement over there, that's falling into Machtia Rabim, meaning people go to look for the advertisement, and then they begin to see all the Lashon Hara and the gossip, and then obviously it leads to false hatred, Sinat Chinam, it all kinds of wars and problems and Chilul Hashem. I want to tell you something. I got a letter from India, an email yesterday, as one Indian goy, non-Jew, that listened to me for 2 years, and he's dreaming that one day he will have money to come to the United States and convert, because they're very poor over there in India where he lives. And he wrote to me yesterday, if there will be another Holocaust, that 80% of the Jews will die, I won't have one question against God. That's what he told me, this non-Jew. What? When I just see how these evil people attacked you like murderers in cold blood with no mercy, no integrity, curses you as someone who makes so many people Balei Tshuva. In case you don't know, I worked for 22 years and I met approximately 150,000 Jews Shomrei Shabbos. I have more than 1,000 people sit in yeshivot all day and learn Torah. I have more than 30 rabbis, some of them Rashi Yeshivot, that I picked up from the street, where they were 100% like Goyim, and I turned them to who they are, and today they are Rashi Yeshivot in Israel and some other parts of the world. All my life I dedicated for the Jewish nation. I work 18 to 20 hours a day. I don't work for organization. Nobody pays me salary. I have no life, no wife, no children. I cannot see them. Barely, I don't speak one sentence to them per day. Barely on Shabbos, I see my family for 22 years like this. And look what they are doing. Instead of having a little respect, say, listen, after all, it's not just a person. This is someone who does so much for the Jewish nation. Hurting him is hurting Hashem directly. It's a direct attack against Hashem.
Rabbi, I have an email from a Moshe Rubin from Borough Park, and his question is, why do so many of the blogs that are, I don't want to say what he writes here, but he says that are basically Moilech Rachel Bamecha, that are full of Lashon Hara and gossip, go by the most religious names like Das Torah and Yeshiva World, both of which are full of Lashon Hara and Rechilus? Why don't they pick less religious names?
Because if they would just become an ordinary secular website, they have a lot more competition. They want to target the from world. The answer to your question is exactly like why every other Reform temple called himself Bet El, the house of God, when every normal person understands that God never entered that building for 1 second ever. You understand? Same thing. Why would they call it Bet El? Or how do you want them to call it? Bet Anti-El? Watch how they should call it. This is how the fakers are. They come with names that are appealing. How are the missionaries attacking me, the Christian missionaries? They come, supposedly they come to promote me, and they tag their nonsense on my YouTube films that people would hear what they have to say about JC and the rest of their nonsense.
Well, Rabbi Mizrahi, thank you very much for bringing this topic to our attention. And I saw your apology. I saw it was posted online. And I would just hope that all the people who listen to this and who additionally who go to the blogs like Yeshiva World, Das Torah, etc., or Das Hepecha Torah, that's what it should be called, would ask these bloggers to please not use a religious name to trample all over the Torah Kedoshah. Thank you very much for joining us, Rabbi Mizrahi.
Thank you for having me. All the best. Kol tov.
Well, I'd like to reiterate to everybody here that I don't agree with many of the opinions of Rabbi Mizrahi. But notwithstanding that, not agreeing with somebody's opinion does not give me or anybody the right to either be mevazeh them berabim, to humiliate them, to make ad hominem attacks. He's a worthwhile, honest, hardworking person who's put the greater has poured his life's passion into Yiddishkeit, into Kirov. He's spoken for tens of thousands of hours, and there are going to be snippets of there that people will disagree with. That doesn't allow us to humiliate him, to speak Lashon Hara about him, Rechilus about him, to be over the Yud Zayin Klolus, etc. That's Aser, Lahalacha, either Baal Peh or Biksav. And the fact that the internet gives a disinhibition effect where people feel they can do anything anonymously, or that the owners of these blogs feel that for the purpose of getting ratings and advertisements they could be over all the Isurim and the Torah, that's wrong, even if we disagree with some of his opinions. Yes, Abaye and Rava were frequently wrong, but we didn't call them out. There was no right. Okay, let's move on. Next week we have a fascinating guest. His name is Rabbi Meir Gershon from Australia, and he has created a herd of Ben Pakuas, which are animals that there is no tarfus on. You could eat filet mignon because they don't require nikur. There's no gid hanasha. It's controversial. It's Shulchan Aruch. It's Eisgehalten. But will it break barriers? And it's just a fascinating topic. We've always wanted to know, what does filet mignon taste like? Well, you actually can have it. And according to some Achrayim, it could even have a cheeseburger. He's going to take that position. We'll see whether we agree with it or not. So he's going to be our guest by phone from Australia. I have to do the interview, the 24-hour time lapse. I'm going to do it one day. For him, it's the next day. I look forward to seeing you next week. This is Headlines Radio. Thank you.